This is lecture 3 of the lecture cycle by Rudolf Steiner entitled Initiate Consciousness. Lecture 3 is entitled Form and Substantiality of the Mineral in Relation to the States of Human Consciousness. I endeavored yesterday to show what is the nature of the soul's inner experience when man raises himself through training, through soul exercises, to different states of consciousness. And I sought to show how that which is known in the ordinary state of consciousness only as the chaotic, disordered experiences of dreams arising during the condition of sleep may be transmuted into fully conscious, exact waking experiences, how one thus attains to a state of consciousness lying in a sense next to that of ordinary consciousness, a state in which one first perceives the animal world in its totality, and sees how it extends upward into a higher world, a soul world, an astral world. I sought then to show how the plant carpet of the earth appears in its totality, when in still another condition of consciousness, which proceeds from the state of consciousness fully awake but empty as regards the physical world, one raises oneself to the world of the stars, and in this world first comes to know the truth concerning the plant carpet of the earth. When one then has the insight that what we behold as the plants springing up out of the earth is a mirrored image of something majestic and sublime that shines upon us first out in the cosmos, somewhat as the dew pearls shine on the plants on earth. I wish to say that what is there, spread out in cosmic space over the heavens, takes on essential being, takes on form, takes on colors, takes on even tones, when in this manner, with empty consciousness, we raise ourselves up to its height. Then we can look back to the earth and perceive the very truth regarding the plant world, that it is a mirrored image of cosmic being, of a cosmic process of events, etc. Now, in viewing the world of the stars on the one hand, and the plant world on the other, we must observe a certain peculiarity, and I wish to describe these things entirely from inner experience, simply as they actually occur. My description shall not be based upon any sort of literary or other tradition. It will be based upon nothing traditional whatever, but I shall, above all, describe these things as they appear to direct spiritual experience and research. Here I wish to point out first a peculiarity which appears to one who sees into these things in the way I have described. Suppose that we have the world of stars here, there the terrestrial world. Parenthesis, when we are making an observation, we always stand at a certain point, which we may call our point of view. Parenthesis. Then, through the second state of consciousness, which I have described, the consciousness that beholds the stars and the plants together, I become clearly aware that the true forms are there above me, and these mirror themselves, not like ordinary reflections, but as the real plants which are produced by the reflection from the earth mirror. Such is the vision. One can describe this vision by saying, there above, the cosmic life, below, the earth as a mirror. Naturally, not like dead, unreal, shadowy, mirrored images do the plants come forth, but like a real reflection produced by the earth. Yet one always has the feeling, the earth must be below there. A mirror must be there, in order that what is in the cosmos may spring forth out of the earth. Without the earth on which we stand, on which we move about, there would be no plants, just as a mirror, when we stand before it, opposes itself to the light, just as there must be resistance, for we should not otherwise see the mirror, so also must the earth be there, as that which mirrors, in order for the plants to come into existence. But we can go further. When, from the second consciousness that I described yesterday, the waking emptiness of consciousness, we pass on to the development of a force of the soul, not ordinarily prized as a force of cognition, the force of love for all things, for all beings. When we permeate ourselves wholly with this force, after we have come forth into this utterly different world, which reveals the cosmos to us, not bright with the stars, but manifesting real being. After we have come forth, I would say, into the spiritual ocean of the universe, If we can then retain what we possess on the earth also as an endowment of our organization of spirit, soul, and body, if we can retain and immeasurably expand the force of love, the self-surrender to all beings, then do we develop ever more and more the forces also of our knowledge. And then do we attain to the capacity to survey clairvoyantly not merely the animal kingdom, the plant kingdom, but also the mineral kingdom, primarily to be sure that mineral kingdom which by its nature contains the crystal. Crystals, mineral crystals, become a wonderful object of research and observation for one who wishes to penetrate into the higher spiritual worlds. If one has disciplined oneself by the vision of the animal world and the plant world, one can then attain to the world of the crystallized minerals. Again, one feels impelled to raise one's eyes from the mineral crystals that confront one on the earth to the universe, to the cosmos. Again, in the distant spaces of the cosmos, one beholds that which is possessed of being, as one beholds what lies at the basis of the plant existence, but the whole vision is now different. When one proceeds from a crystallized mineral, one experiences something quite different from what is experienced when proceeding from the plant world. Again, out in the universe, one experiences that which is possessed of being. Again, one says to oneself, what we see below in the earthly existence as crystallized mineral is brought into being by something spiritually living in the expanse of the cosmos. But when this sends its influence downward, it is not mirrored on the earth or by the earth. This, you see, is the essential thing. When, from the mineral, we raise ourselves into the cosmos and look back again to the earth is no longer a mirror for that which is mineral in character. It is as if the earth were not there at all. It vanishes from our view. We cannot say, as we can of the plants, there below is the earth, it reflects. No, it does not reflect. It acts as if it were not there at all. When we have concentrated ourselves upon such a view, which proceeds from the crystallized mineral, when we have directed our look outward to the expanses of the world, and have again looked back, there is then below us a terrifying abyss. At first a terrifying, fearful nothingness. We must wait, but we must have presence of mind. The waiting cannot endure for long. If we wait too long, the anxiety will become overwhelming, for we feel that we have lost the ground from beneath our feet. This is an entirely unaccustomed feeling, which manifests itself as an overwhelming anxiety. If we do not possess presence of mind and do not actively force our way through this nothingness, we must look through the earth. That is, the earth is not there. We must look further because it is not there. And we are compelled, in the case of minerals, to view not only what is above us, but also the whole surrounding sphere. The earth must be as if blotted out of existence. We must look downward as well as upward, to the west as well as to the east. Then there comes toward us, from the other side, a stream which moves upward in contrast to the stream which is present, indeed also in the case of the plants, but which moves from above downward. And when we look outward, and a current comes from that direction, another comes from the opposite side. We behold currents of the cosmos meeting one another here from all directions. They mutually encounter. They encounter down there below us. So we have currents for the plants moving downward from above. The earth offers resistance to these, and the plants grow out of this. But when we observe a current for the mineral kingdom, we have here an opposing current, and through their meeting together does the form of the mineral kingdom come into existence. Here a current, there, and there an opposing current, here again a current, and there an opposing current, and so forth. And the mineral comes freely into existence from the meeting of these currents out of the all of the cosmos. For the crystallized mineral, the earth is no mirror. Nothing is then mirrored in the earth. Everything there is mirrored in its own element. When we look out upon the mountains and find a quartz crystal, it is, of course, ordinarily resting on its lower surfaces, but it has merely been frustrated in that respect by the earthly element. Aramonic powers have there intervened disorderingly. In reality, it is so formed that the spiritual element darts together from all sides. It is reflected, and you see the quartz crystal floating free in the universe. In every single crystal that forms itself completely on all sides, one may behold a little world. But there are many crystal forms: cubes, octahedrons, tetrahedrons, dodecahedrons, rhomboids, dodecoid forms, monoclinic forms, triclinic forms. We see these. We see how the currents come together, encounter one another. We have a quartz crystal, a prism of six facets with six-sided pyramidal ends. Here we have a salt crystal, which may be cubical. Here a crystal of pyrites, which may be dodecahedron. We look at all this. Each of these crystals comes into existence as I have described, and we must say to ourselves, therefore, there are as many variously formed world currents, really as many space worlds. There is not only a single world, there are as many space worlds as the crystal forms of which the earth is composed. We get a vision of an immeasurableness of worlds. We look at the salt crystal and say to ourselves, out there in the universe exists something possessed of being. The salt crystal is the manifestation to us of something that pervades as real being the entire cosmic space, a world in itself. We look at a crystal of pyrites, also a cube or a dodecahedron, and say to ourselves, something exists out there in the universe that fills the whole of cosmic space. For us, the crystal is the imprint, the manifestation of a whole world. We look upon many things possessed of being, each of which embraces a world within itself. And here on the earth we stand as the human being and say to ourselves, in the earthly element, the deeds of many worlds mutually encounter. And while we men think and act on the earth, there flow into our thinking and acting the thoughts and the deeds of the most manifold beings. In the immeasurably manifold forms of the crystals, we behold a revelation of a great plenitude of beings who live themselves out in the mathematical forms of the crystals. In the crystals, we behold the gods. This is something far more real. Thus, in reverence toward the universe, even in a sort of adoration to the universe, to permit these wonderful mysteries to work upon the soul, than to know anything whatever theoretically with one's head. And anthroposophy ought to teach this experience of feeling oneself within the universe. Through anthroposophy, one ought to be able to feel in every single crystal the weaving and the ruling of a god within the universe. Then the whole human soul is filled with world content, not only the head, with thought. Anthroposophy exists least of all for the purpose of filling the head with thought. Anthroposophy exists in order that the whole man may be filled with light in regard to the universe, with reverence and with adoration toward the universe. Into all the objects and into all the occurrences of the world there should enter, I would say, the inner sacrificial service of the human being. And this sacrificial service should become knowledge. When one stands confronting universal space, the space cosmos, and looks into that which fashions itself over against one out of the crystallized mineral world toward the earth, then one has at first a satisfying impression. Only one yields very soon to the renewal of that state of anxiety, that state of fear of which I have spoken. Before one has experienced this God-permeated crystallized world, one has the anxiety described. This vanishes, this anxiety, when one beholds this God-permeated, crystallized world. But this condition also ceases after a certain time, for there comes over one a peculiar feeling. The feeling, all that forms itself there as the crystal, will sustain thee only in part. Let us take the example which I have selected, a salt crystal that we look upon, a crystal of pyrites, a metal crystal. When we look then upon the crystal of pyrites, we have the feeling, there thou canst build, that will sustain thee. When we look upon the salt crystal, this will so appear to us as if we might fall through it, as if it would not sustain us. In short, what was present before as the great fear lest we should sink because the earth had become a nothingness, this is present again partially in reference to certain forms. And especially there mingles in this feeling that has now come over us a moral element. In the moment when we are for the second time permeated through and through by this fear, we feel within ourselves not only all the sins we have actually committed in the course of our lives, but also all of which we might even be capable, that we might possibly commit. All this is like a great weight hanging upon us that would hurl us into the void, into the abyss that has been opened up for us by the mineral crystals through which we might fall. We must then be able to attain to still another feeling, still another experience. Courage must go along with all through which we are passing, the courage arising from the fact that we say to ourselves, "But thou hast something within thine own inner being that will not permit thee to fall, either below or above, either toward the right or toward the left. Thou hast the center of gravity of thine own being within thyself." Never in one's whole life, you may rest assured, does one need greater self-confidence, greater inner courage, than in that moment when the leaden weight of one's own egoism, for all sins are forms of egoism, of one's own egoism weighs down upon one's soul in the presence of the crystallized mineral world. This transparence, that is, this penetrability through which one might fall, becomes then indeed a fearful admonisher. If one maintains one's courage, says to oneself, "A drop of the divine is within thee, thou canst not sink below, thou art in thy very nature divine." If this becomes an experience, not a mere theory, then does one attain to the courage to sustain oneself and the will to go still further. And now one learns to know something else belonging to the minerals. Hitherto one has learned to know the crystallized nature of the minerals. Now one learns their substantiality, their metallity, that which penetrates inwardly into them as substance. Hitherto the form, now that which permeates it as substance. One comes to know how one is sustained in the universe in various ways by representative basic metals. One learns, now, to know oneself as man in his relationship to the cosmos. One learns to know the individual metallities, the substantialities of the mineral nature. One learns really to feel within oneself that central point of which I have just spoken. Now you must not conceive in a material fashion what I am saying, even though I must express it in words that denote material substance. When one says heart, head, the present-day materialistically minded man thinks of the physical head, the physical heart. But all this is at the same time spiritual. This has all been built up out of spirit. And when now man in his totality, with his spirit, soul, physical being, is viewed entirely spiritually, quite immaterially, we have the very clear feeling it is in the heart primarily that the center of gravity lies, which will not permit one to sink, to fly away in space, which presses neither toward the left nor toward the right, but holds one fast. If one maintains that courage I have just described, then one comes to find oneself held fast within the universe. But what does this mean, to find oneself held fast within the universe? Well, when a person loses consciousness, faints away, he is not held fast. When he has a powerful inward sensation of pain, so that he has a stronger inward feeling of himself than in ordinary life, for pain is an intensification of the inner feeling, then again he is not in the customary consciousness. Pain drives out the customary consciousness. In the ordinary life on earth, between birth and death, man has a kind of medium consciousness. He must maintain himself in this state. If this consciousness becomes too attenuated, he becomes faint. If it grows too compact, too dense, too strongly conscious within itself, pain arises. This passing out into nothingness is in a swoon. This being too much compressed together in pain, these are both aberrations of consciousness in two opposite directions. This is just the feeling one has in the presence of the crystallized mineral world, when one has not yet grasped the metallic nature, the substantiality. The feeling that at any moment one might faint away and dissolve into the universe, or be crushed together in pain, might collapse. Then the feeling comes over one. At that point where physically the muscles of the heart lie, everything is concentrated, which gives us a firm hold. If the person has found his way in consciousness as far as I have just described, he becomes aware that all which holds him in the earthly consciousness, in the waking earthly consciousness, which makes this consciousness a so-called normal state, if I may use the ugly humdrum word normal, that this is the gold, aurum, A-U-R-U-M, aurum, disseminated in most extraordinary minuteness throughout the world, but working upon no other organ so directly as upon the heart. If one has hitherto become aware of the formation, the crystallization of the mineral element, one now becomes aware of its substantiality, its metallic nature. One feels how the metallity works upon man himself. Out there we see the crystalline mineral form, which gives shape to the metallic. But within ourselves, we know that our heart bears the force which is disseminated in extremely minute proportions in gold throughout the universe, and that our heart thus sustains the consciousness we possess when we are living the life of day in ordinary daytime life. Thus we may say that gold works on man's heart. We may now carry on our researches. While we thus recall to mind the metal gold, of what sort it is, concentrate upon its color, upon its hardness, upon its whole substantiality, and have this inner experience that gold has to do with our hearts, we may then bring the matter to the point where, through other concentrations, through concentration, for instance, upon iron and its characteristics, we may come to know how iron works. Gold works upon the inner man with immeasurable harmonizing effect, establishing a state of balance. There comes about an inner equilibrium through the action of gold. If we concentrate strongly upon iron, after we have learned to know it well, if we forget the whole universe and concentrate exclusively upon iron, so that we ourselves in our soul life pass over, in a certain sense, wholly into iron, become iron, experience ourselves as iron, we then feel as if our consciousness were rising upward out of the heart. We still feel quite clear, but we have the feeling that the consciousness rises out of the heart and penetrates as far as the throat, the larynx. If one has practiced the exercises sufficiently, this does no harm. But if one has not practiced these exercises enough, a slight faintness comes about. One learns to know this mild form of swoon associated with the mounting upward of consciousness, either through actually falling into a mild swoon, or through the fact that one has developed inner activity, strong forces of consciousness. Then one transfers oneself gradually into this mounting upward of the consciousness and attains to that world through a method such as I have described, which I mentioned yesterday as the method through which one sees the animals and their species souls. This time, however, one has entered into the astral world by reason of having concentrated upon the metallity of iron. If a person deals with the form of the metals, he comes to the divine beings. If he deals with the metallity, with the substantiality, he enters into the astral world, into that which is astral in nature, into the world of the soul. Here, he feels the consciousness rising to the throat. He enters into another sphere of consciousness, knows that this is due to concentration upon iron, has the feeling that he is by no means the same person as before. When in full consciousness, in exact consciousness, he enters into this state, he has the feeling that he is no longer the same human being as before. He has become etheric. He has mounted upward out of himself, has become etheric. The earth passes away. It no longer interests him. But he lifts himself up into the planetary sphere, which is now, so to speak, his dwelling place. Thus one passes ever more and more out of oneself into the universe. The path from gold to iron is the path outward into the universe. We may continue further. In the same manner that I have described in reference to gold and iron, we may now concentrate, for example, upon tin, a different metal, again upon the metallity, upon the color it has, its consistency, so that we become entirely tin in our consciousness. We feel that consciousness mounts still further upward. We feel, if we go through this experience unprepared, without the necessary exercises, we feel ourselves falling into a very deep swoon, into a spark of consciousness. Only a spark of consciousness now remains. And if we have carried out these exercises, we maintain ourselves in this swoon and feel in contrast how we are slipping still further outside our body. Now we slip still further out. We feel that consciousness has now mounted upward even to the region of the eyes. We feel ourselves outside in the expanse of the universe. Yet we feel ourselves to be still within the stars. But the earth now begins to be visible like a remote star. We think to ourselves, there below thou hast left thy body upon the earth. Thou hast now come up hither into the cosmos. Thou art sharing the experience of the life of the stars. You will understand, however, that what I am now describing to you is by no means so entirely simple. For what I am describing to you, what one experiences in treading the way of initiation, parenthesis, the experience that causes us to feel on this way of initiation, thy consciousness is in thy larynx, thou hast thy consciousness, but it is the consciousness within the larynx, that one feels. Thy consciousness is there in the lower parts of the head and in the forehead, parenthesis. This experience indicates that all of this is always present within man himself. All of you who are sitting here have these forms of consciousness within you, only you do not know it. But how do you have them within you? Truly, you must understand, man is by no means a simple being. The moment you should become conscious of the entire organization of your larynx, if you could obliterate your brain, could obliterate your senses, should develop your consciousness as a man in your larynx and what pertains to it, you would always have this slight subconscious sense of faintness. But indeed, you do have it. It is simply hidden away beneath the ordinary consciousness of the heart, by the gold consciousness. Within all of you is present this consciousness I have just described. A part of your human being possesses it. A part of your being as man lives outside there among the stars, not at all present up upon the earth. Still farther outside in the universe lives the tin consciousness. It is not at all true that you live only on the earth. You live on the earth by reason of the fact that you possess a heart. This holds your consciousness together upon the earth. That which is present in the larynx, iron, lives outside in the universe, and, still further outside, lives what is present in the head above the eyes, tin. Iron reaches upward even as far as Mars. Tin reaches upward even as far as Jupiter. Only by reason of gold are we here upon the earth. You are always in the universe. Only this is concealed from you by the heart consciousness. If now you come to the concentration for lead or some similar metal, again as to its substantiality, its metallity, then you pass entirely outside yourself. It then becomes entirely clear to you, there below upon the earth remains thy physical body, and also thy ether body. That is something alien to thee. It is there below. It pertains to thee just as little as does the stone that lies upon the mountainside. Consciousness has now mounted upward, outside you here, beyond the upper part of the head. In the universe there is ever present a very fine dissemination of lead. This consciousness there, above, reaches far out in the distance. And as to what still remains within the skull in connection with this state of human consciousness, as to that, man is now in a state of complete swoon. Think of the illusions in which a man lives. As he sits at his desk and writes accounts or articles, he believes that he is thinking with his head. But this is not at all true. The head is by no means upon the earth. Only in its external manifestation is it upon the earth. The head extends from the throat outward into the universe. The universe merely manifests itself in the head. What causes you to be an earth being upon this earth between birth and death? This is the heart. And when one writes good or bad articles, accounts that overcharge someone or do not overcharge him, this all comes out of the heart. It is only an illusion to think that man lives on the earth with his head. He does not live with his head on the earth. The head is really in a permanent swoon. That is the reason, indeed, why it can ache in such an extraordinary fashion, as other organs do not ache. Parenthesis, I will discuss this idea further, parenthesis. So that, if we reflect upon this, in the effort to get to the bottom of the question as to what we are, there really hangs over us a continuous threat on the side of the spirit that our head might be split to pieces into the universe, that the entire consciousness might pass out upwards into a vast swoon. But all of this is held together by means of the heart. Thus man lives really in such a way that we might say that in the larynx, iron, the consciousness develops which I have described to you as that extending into the realm of the animals, to the animal kingdom, to those higher forms lying at the basis of the animal kingdom. Only nothing of this enters into consciousness in ordinary life. It remains in that place where man ever looks outward toward the stars. It is within this region that he bears always this consciousness. Higher up, in the region of the eyes, tin, is the consciousness of the plant forms. Down below are their mirrored images. And at the very top, where the lead consciousness resides, where we reach outward even as far as Saturn, there our head knows nothing whatever of the articles we write. These we write with our heart. But the head knows everything about all I have here described to you. One can sit, then, describing earthly things, and these come out of the heart. One's head, in the meanwhile, may be interesting itself as to the manner and fashion in which a god reveals himself in a crystal of pyrites, in a salt crystal, in a quartz crystal. If the initiate consciousness looks down now toward these chairs, your hearts are listening to what I am saying, but the three states of consciousness lying one above the other are out there in the cosmos. There, things are happening that are of quite a different nature from what belongs to the ordinary earth consciousness. In all that is there occurring, in all that is ever there outspread, exist primarily those living threads which spin for every man his karma. Thus, you see, one learns gradually out of the universe to understand the human being, and we have thus learned to know man, who is really bound up with the outer world, who continually threatens to fly to pieces outwards, to faint away outwards, but who is held together by his heart. We move spiritually in quite another direction if we fix our concentration in certain different ways upon certain other kinds of metallities. Just as we can do this in the case of iron, tin, lead, so can we also, for instance, with copper. We may concentrate upon the metallity of copper, enter in a certain fashion into the copper, become entirely copper in our soul life, in the color, in the consistency, in that characteristic corrugated surface of copper, in short, in all that one may experience in soul in the metallity of copper. Now we do not have the feeling of passing into a swoon, but something quite contrary happens. We have the feeling of being inwardly filled with something. We have inwardly more feeling of ourselves than is customary. Actually, we have this feeling, that this copper, about which we have been thinking concentratedly, fills us from above below, even to the very fingertips, everywhere, even to the very skin. It fills us. It fills us with something. It then radiates outward from this middle point, which lies below the heart, into the entire body. Thus we have the feeling of a second body within us, a second man. We feel ourselves under an inward pressure. A slight pain begins and this increases. We feel everything inwardly under pressure. Again, however, by means of the initiate feeling, we penetrate through all this, and in this manner we actually feel a second man within man. And it is significant if we can, with this initiate feeling, have such an experience that we can say to ourselves, with thy customary human being who belongs to thee by reason of birth and education, with whom thou goest about in the world, with whom thou seest with thine eyes into the world, with whom thou hearest, with whom thou feelest things, with this human being thou goest about. But by reason of the fact that thou art trained, that thou hast carried through certain exercises, by this reason thou hast also brought this man, this second man, who now presses thee outward, to the state in which he also possesses the power of perception. He becomes, of course, a peculiar man, this second man. He does not possess such separate eyes and ears. He is, as it were, all eye and ear, but he is like a sense organ. He perceives subtly. Indeed, he perceives things that we ourselves do not otherwise perceive. The world is suddenly enriched. Then, like a snake casting off its skin, one can, for a certain time, which is not long, but may continue only for seconds, yet one experiences a very great deal in seconds under these circumstances, one can pass out of the body and move about freely as a spirit in the world, in company with this second man who is formed there within one, let us say, as the copper man. He can be separated, even though all this is painful, and even though the pain increases, he can be separated from the body. One can thus pass outward. And now, when one has thus passed outward, one can experience more than when one remains within the body. Most important of all, if one has achieved this capacity of passing out of the body, one can follow a person who has died into that world which he enters after a few days. Suppose, then, that someone has passed through the portal of death, and all relationships that one had as an earthly human being with this man have ceased. He is cremated or buried. He is no longer there upon the earth. When, with this man whom I have described, one passes out of the body, one can then follow further the soul that has passed through the portal of death. One remains in company with this soul, and one then learns that in the first years and decades after passing through the portal of death, this soul retraces its life in reverse order. This becomes a truth to one. One can observe it. One can go still further with the soul. One sees that the soul experiences in reverse order what it experienced in the days preceding death on the earth. The last, first of all, then the next to the last, and so on. It experiences all in reverse order. All the way back to the time of birth, the man passes through his life in one-third of its actual duration. If a person was 60 years old, he lives in reverse order about 20 years, passing through the whole life backward. There, one can follow him. The characteristic thing here is that one learns to know from human beings very much about what the state of things is immediately after death. Not only does a person live through things in the order opposite to that in which he experienced them on earth, pardon me if I use a crude illustration. Suppose that 3 years before your death you gave someone a box on the ear, for I will use a crude illustration. You were angry with him, your anger vented itself. I know perfectly well, of course, that no one who is sitting here would do this, but I will select a crude illustration. Well, suppose you were angry, and your anger vented itself, and you caused pain in soul and body to another person. You had a sense of satisfaction. You were content. You punished him for what he had done to you. Now, when you pass backward and come to this incident, you will arrive at this incident after a year. You do not then experience what you previously experienced as your anger, but what he received as suffering of body and soul. You enter vitally into him. In the realm of the soul, you yourself now receive the box on the ear. You have actually to feel in turn the bodily pain. So it is with all incidents. You experience the incidents as the other persons have experienced them. In all this, one can follow the person. You must understand that men once knew more about all these things in the age of which I have spoken to you during these days, among the ancient Chaldeans, who received their cultural impulses out of the mysteries. This was very remarkable in the case of these Chaldeans. Men did not then live so much from the heart as today, but in the case of the Chaldeans, they really lived from the larynx. The Chaldeans had a sort of iron consciousness as their natural state. They possessed an experience outside in the universe. The earth did not appear to them so hard and compact. But when they lived in especially favorable hours out there, for example on Mars, living with the Mars beings, then there might chance to be a moment when beings came over from the moon and brought with them just such beings as one becomes aware of when one is in this second man whom I have described. The Chaldeans then learned in a roundabout way in the universe lofty truths related to the life after death. They were instructed outside in the universe. Today we do not need this. We can follow the dead man directly. We can accompany him as he passes through his experiences in the reverse order, but also in the transposed relationships. And the peculiar thing is that when anyone has thus passed as the second man out of the body, he feels that he is in a world far, far more real than our earthly world. The earthly world and all that he has there experienced then appears to him like shadows, in contrast to the solid, convincing reality into which he has now entered. When one accompanies the dead in the manner described, One feels everything to be twice as heavy, three times as heavy, three times as bright, three times as loud. Everything far more real, and the whole physical world appears very shadowy. Whoever has intercourse with this world through the initiate consciousness, for him the physical world becomes a collection of paintings. It might be that such an initiate, whose duties had caused him to hold much intercourse with the dead, would say to you, "All of you are really only paintings. You are certainly no reality. There you are, painted on your chairs." For the genuine realities are discovered first on the other side of existence. There everything is far more real. This reality can indeed be experienced. Perhaps some of you recall my mystery plays. In these there appears a figure called Strader. This Strader figure is drawn from life. There was a person in the last third of the 19th century who lived over into the 20th century of whom Strader is a copy, but done artistically, poetically, not as a photograph. Now, this personality interested me deeply as a person while alive. During his lifetime, he was a Capuchin, but he had then changed his religion and become a philosopher, spent some time in the cloister at Dornach. This person who interested me so much while alive, I adapted and modified. He lives as Strader in my mystery plays, only in a similitude, not identical. Then came the fourth mystery play. You know that in the fourth mystery, Strader dies. I had to let him die. I could not continue further. I could not have treated the figure of Strader further. He could never have appeared again in a fifth mystery. The pen would have fallen from my hand if I had wished to write anything more about him, characterize him further. But why did this happen? Just for the reason that in the meanwhile the real person had died, he who had changed from a Capuchin to a philosopher. Through the interest I felt in this personality, I could follow him into the other world. There his effect is far more real. Then what could next have been written in the physical world ceases to have so strong an interest as that which one now experiences with such a personality when following him after death. And something peculiar took place. A few anthroposophists became acquainted with these factual relationships. It leaked out, for many men are very shrewd, are they not, that Strader was a sort of copy of that man. They made inquiries and got hold of his literary legacy and various interesting things that this man had left behind, brought these to me, assuming that I would conceive a tremendous interest in all that this person had left behind him. I could take no interest whatever in the things. On the contrary, I was interested in everything the man was doing after his death. That is far more real. In the presence of that, everything which represents the external, all that he had left behind, disappeared from view. At first people were surprised that I was so uninterested, after so much pains had been taken to get possession of all sorts of things from the literary legacy, which I felt no desire to have. Not even today have I taken them. But the situation is simply this. Earthly realities become illusions in the presence of the mighty realities that meet us when we follow an individuality after death, where he stands in that world we experience within ourselves, when, in the manner I have described, we are filled by that man who can be released from the body even though only for a brief time. But in a brief time one can experience very much. Actually bordering on our physical world, there is this world in which, so to speak, the dead immediately live, and they live far more really than do we, and we experience them by means of that man who steps outside. We are not now in a swoon. Our consciousness is more concentrated. When we move in consciousness above the heart, consciousness then becomes more attenuated. We come near swooning. But if we move downward below the heart, consciousness condenses. We enter into the worlds that are real. Only one must be able to endure it. These press upon one. They are painful. But if we thrust ourselves forward with sufficient courage, we enter. Thus we have the ordinary consciousness of the day in our hearts, a second consciousness in the larynx, a third consciousness in the region of the eyes, a fourth consciousness above in the head, which leads wholly out into the cosmos, and then a fifth consciousness below the heart, which leads us not into the space worlds, but backward into the periods of time. We move through time. We make a path in time. We make a path in time when we come to this fifth consciousness. The path which the dead travel in reverse order is the one now taken. We have stepped out of space and passed over into time. You will see that everything depends upon the transition to different states of consciousness. Here on earth man lives in a single world because he possesses only one consciousness, because he is asleep as to the other states of consciousness. If we are not asleep as to these, if we transport ourselves into these other states of consciousness, we then experience the other worlds. Such is the mystery of research in other worlds, that man himself must become different in the nature of his consciousness. For it is not by subtleties, nor by using the same means of research used in ordinary life, that one enters into different worlds, but by means of the metamorphosis, the transformation of consciousness into other states. The end of Lecture 3.